Shall we start? So people are still coming in. I think you've been here long enough. You see such a big crowd, and it's very nice for me to be back here again, launching the Global Civil Society Yearbook 2002. I'm enormously enthusiastic about the whole idea about global civil society, partly because in a sort of systematic way it reminds me a little bit of what we when we were living through the 1960s, why don't we do something about it, rather than saying, why don't they do something for us? This notion that we thought we were taking power into our own hands, and that we were becoming more responsible, more mature, more personally sort of involved citizens. And I think the level of political participation taught us a great deal about involvement as citizens. That whole notion of citizens making links and talking and listening and learning and understanding each other, that encouraging tolerance, which really only comes, doesn't it, from talking to each other and from knowing each other well. This evening's debate is about global civil society before and after September the 11th. We have some wonderful speakers. And no longer, and I'm going to be pretty fierce about that because otherwise you won't get a chance to have a say. There are a few notices which I'll make towards the end of the meeting. Our first speaker is, of course, Mary Caldor, who is the school professor and director of the programme on global civil society at the Centre for the Study of Global Governance at LSE. She's one of the editors of the Global Civil Society Yearbook and co-author of the opening chapter on global civil society before and after September the 11th. Her latest book, Global Society, An Answer to War, will be published by Polity Press in 2003. And there are copies of the book, aren't there, available,
yes,
which are outside, and I think they cost £15.95, and they'll be for sale in the Robinson Room. You can also get a free copy of the first book, CC2001. So make comparisons between what they were up to last year and what the change has been, and I think that's absolutely fascinating. Because I'm very keen on this book, even more so than I was on last year's book, because I think it's got lots of real feeling in it. Because building a global civil society really depends on people feeling confident enough and powerful enough to develop these new egalitarian relationships. It depends on an appreciation of diversity as well, because insular cultures and insular feelings surely reinforce fear and work against that sort of sense of a global civil society. Our speaker is Yasmin Alibaya Brown. She is a senior researcher at the Foreign Policy Centre and writes a weekly column in The Independent. She's a leading commentator on multiculturalism and human rights. She writes regularly for The Guardian, New Statesman, and you will have heard her on the radio, or you may even have seen her on television. Our third participant is Chris Brown, who's a professor here of international relations, and his areas of expertise are international political theory and the ethics of foreign policy, particularly in relation to war and social justice. He's written numerous books on the subject, on these topics, including most recently Sovereignty, Rights and Justice, published in 2002. And finally, Tim Klein is an award-winning journalist, an author of many publications, including the highly successful, which I'm sure you've seen, No Logo, taking aim at the brand bullies. She's a Canadian. She's just taken up a visiting Miliband fellowship with the government department at the LSE. And I was astonished because on Saturday I was rather looking forward to reading Naomi's article on globalization in my copy of The Guardian. And as far as I could see, no other members of my family, because they don't get up before midday anyway, they had their hands on this weekend copy. And Christine, out of the front door, opened it up, and those two pages have been torn out. So I don't know if there's a conspiracy. Either it's Mr. Patel at my, who's very interested in global civil society, at my news agents, or something is going seriously wrong. I shall write to Alan Rusbridger. Let's start first with Mary Caldor.
Well, welcome everybody. It's really wonderful to see so many people here, and I hope you're all going to read the book. When we, Anna quite rightly said that she was chairing a similar event a year ago, and actually what we planned to do a year ago was to launch the yearbook in New York on September the 17th. And of course, we had to cancel. But I think what was very striking was that if you look at the difference between September the 10th and September the 11th, it was all different in the world as far as global civil society is concerned. On September the 10th, and this is how we felt when we issued our first yearbook, global civil society flourished. Our figures showed explosive increase in the numbers of NGOs and the members of NGOs in parallel summits where people take part in conferences. We could point to a whole series of international treaties, the International Criminal Court, the Landmines Convention, the Global Climate Change, in which global civil society had played a key role. The anti-globalization movement that we tend to call the anti-capitalist movement had a series of demonstrations, and for once there seemed to be a real response. At that moment, the World Bank and the IMF were calling for dialogue. The Belgian Prime Minister actually had written a book. The French were going to take some of the proposals. And above all, I would say, there was a real feeling that over the last 10 years, norms and values had become important in the international arena, that we had moved beyond a world which was characterized by naked self-interest states, and it had become possible to talk about international problems as though norms and values were important, the way we talk about domestic problems. And then September the 11th happened. And the attacks of September the 11th were, in my opinion, an attack on global civil society. They were an attack on civilians. They were a crime against humanity. They were a way of saying debate, discussion is irrelevant. And at the same time, and I think it's worth noting that today is the anniversary of October the 7th, when the airstrikes on Afghanistan began. At the same time, the response that gradually emerged from the Bush administration was one that also marked really a return to a state-based type of politics, to a world where states matter, not people. It was a world where there's, as Bush put it, you're either with us or against us. Space for critical dialogue was narrowed. So what we asked ourselves in this yearbook, in fact, half of our first chapter is about global civil society on September the 10th, and the second half is about global civil society after September the 11th. What we asked ourselves was the 1990s a kind of aberration? Was it a happy interregnum when these kinds of things matter? And have we gone back to a world of geopolitics, a world of military power, where movements no longer have a role on the world stage? Well, we don't really, in our book, have an answer to that question, but we try to think of ways to answer it. First of all, I would say we look at what the Bush administration has done, the unilateralist approach of the Bush administration, and we argue, as I said, that this is inapplicable for several reasons. One is the rhetoric of war. The moment that Bush said this was an attack on the United States rather than a crime against humanity, and the response was a war rather than the arrest of war criminals, at that moment it changed the whole nature of what was happening. And it justified all kinds of local wars on terror, which we actually, we have a description of all the ways in which different governments, from Australians concerned about asylum seekers to Russians concerned about Chechens to the Israeli, used the Bush's language to justify, as it were, local wars on terror. And also, of course, the ways in which this war was prosecuted, the use of long-distance bombing, where American casualties were very low, where the whole idea was that somehow American lives were privileged over not only the lives of Afghans, but the lives of all kinds of people in the the rest of the world, who mattered less, and this was also inimical to the assumptions of human equality. But at the same time as one talks about that unilateralist response, we also had elements of a multilateralist response, especially in Europe. Tony Blair came out very rapidly after September the 11th saying, this is the moment for global social justice. This is the moment when we talk to global civil society. This is the moment when we have to take all kinds of measures to right wrongs. This is when we have to have a partnership with Africa. What September the 11th shows is the mutual vulnerability of all of us and the need for multilateral rules. And I suppose what we've tried to argue is that the direction that we go in the future, what September the 11th really means, actually does depend on the reaction of global civil society, on the reaction of people in the street. And what happened to global civil society after September the 11th, and by that I mean the movements, the individuals, I mean the people who strongly supported wars on terror as well as the people who were critical. Well, initially there was silence, but I think what we've seen, which is very interesting, is what we call in the book new synergies. We saw a kind of coming together of, on the one hand, the anti-capitalist movement, on the other hand, the older peace movement, and immigrant groups and Muslim groups suddenly coming together in various of coalitions, which we see in different places, and one saw very vividly on the streets of London last week. At the same time, I think what we've seen is that precisely because of the war on terror, this coalition seems to be more against the war on terror than it's against terror. That's the impression that's given, which it makes it possible, makes it easier to marginalize the movement. And I think one of the worrying features since September the 11th has indeed been the marginalization of the human rights movement, which has been quite divided on how to respond. What we conclude in this chapter is with four possible scenarios that really depend on how different people react. The first scenario is what we call the unilateralist scenario. This is the scenario of an American-dominated, globalized world in which there is an active movement, but the active movement is marginalized by being treated as the enemy, dubbed sympathetic to the Islamists, and the world is polarized. There's not much space for critical debate and reflection. And it's a nasty, violent world in which there are preemptive strikes and terror feed on each other. The second scenario we describe is what we call the bargaining scenario, which is sort of based on the Cold War, the idea that maybe the Europeans and others will get more in the way of global social justice in exchange for agreeing to the war on terror. And in a way, that's what happened in the Cold War. Suddenly, we in Europe were allowed to have our welfare state in exchange for being part of the Cold War division. Again, in that case, you might imagine this is a situation where some bits of the global civil society, the NGOs, the developing people, decide to go in that direction and not hold together on the fundamental issues of war and not war. The third scenario is the division scenario, a growing division between Europe and America, in which the European states pursue their multilateralist goals and become more on the side of the activists. And there's a great conflict. But the activists fail to convince, for example, civil society in America or civil society in Israel. So there's a polarization on the world scene. And our final scenario is what we call the utopian scenario, in which win, and in which there really is a coming together from below, in which there is an attempt to convince Americans that they need to pursue a different path, to convince Israelis that they need a kind of partnership with Palestinians. So that's what we say in our first chapter, and because I've come to the end of my 10 minutes, I won't tell you much about the rest of the book, but you can ask me questions.
Thank you, Mary.
Should we
I want people to ask you questions?
No, I think we should go straight on.
Yasmin.
I'm not part of this project, though it's an excellent piece of work, and obviously there's much in it that you know, is completely sold to my heart. However, I would like to begin with questioning the premise almost, because I've found it increasingly difficult to live with the constant refrain that September the 11th must, for all of us, whoever we are around the world, be the most significant event of all time. I find that quite hard to buy into, and more so since the surfeit of remembrance that we had around the 3 weeks around September the 11th, and the almost total absence of any remembrance today. So I want to question that, and not as, because I don't think one needs a kind of peg. I'm a journalist, I know what a peg means and how to listen if you attach these very important debates to something that is understood. But I do think for progressive thinking, we need to always question that premise. I wrote a column on the 10th of September, as it happened, which 1,200 words, asking the West and Europe and British Muslims to do something about Taliban. This was on the 10th of September, and I often wonder where the world was on the 10th of September when many of us involved in human rights work were asking these questions about what Taliban had been doing. While we were writing these articles, businessmen from the United States and from many other parts of the world were in Afghanistan to do all sorts of interesting deals. But nobody seemed that bothered. They were very bothered when the statues were blown up. That was about the only time I remember there being sustained interest for a couple of days. So I question the premise only because I suspect that there are many more people, even within Europe, who don't share of monumental event, actually, who feel quite worried that we have bought into that premise with because it was, as you said in the book, you know, we saw it. But I don't think that's the only reason. I do think it has entirely everything to do with certain lives, certain events and where they happen. And the perceptions from where we sit. I mean, somebody said to me, well, what in the last 10 years, what is the thing that changed your life? And I have to be honest. And for me, my sense of security the day Srebrenica happened. Because here we were, never again in Europe, under the safety of the United Nations, cold-blooded slaughter of young men and boys, whether they were Muslim or not, is you know, not the point. These were Europeans. Happened in our Europe. And my whole sense, actually post-war sense of security, was more shaken then than, frankly, you know, what I've been told I must think about September the 11th. It was tragic what happened. You know, several thousand people died, 80 nationalities. We, you know, this is not at all, you know, saying I don't care. I do think we have to be careful how we begin to make these arguments, because if the premise itself alienates so many people, then maybe the arguments are not easily won. Over 230 people, I think, some about Africans died in the first Al-Qaeda bomb in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. Do we even know their names? Do you not think that with the remembrance that we had, that somebody would have had the political sense, nothing else, the political sense to include those names in the list of people who were destroyed? So I have a problem with that. I'll put that on the cards. The other very important thing, and I think Abdallah's paper really highlighted it very well in the book, is the absolute need, and I agree with Mary, there is this absolute need we have. We were in the middle of convergence in the world, I do agree with. And that convergence, that idea, whether we were talking about it in Britain, I mean, the two books I wrote last year and the year before, about needing to get away from the kind of tribalized politics of old multiculturalism into a much more binding set of values around human rights, those sorts of ideas were beginning to take hold in Britain, in Europe. We were beginning to get our heads around the fact that diversity of all sorts was what made us who we were, whether it was individual difference or group diversity, but that diversity in itself, it could become a prison for the kinds of values we wanted to see around the world. They weren't Western values. It was beginning, we were beginning to shatter those images of these are Western values, these are not our values, gender equality. All the progressive gains were being made, and of course, September 11th shattered those. Because from that slow convergence, I think we're now back to a terrible, terrible fragmentation and dangerous enmities. I think I totally agree with Al Gore that, in a sense, Britain and the United States squandered an extraordinary moment of global empathy, which really existed, whoever we were, you know. I remember my 82-year-old mother weeping and weeping and weeping the day this happened on the 11th of September. You know, she just, the kind of emotional bond everybody felt with the victims and with, you know, the deaths. And also a new sense of urgency that we had to do something about it was around the world, wherever we lived. And I think that's been squandered. And I think that's been squandered and led us to a very, very dangerous position, increasingly so, as the boys go to war. And the boys will go to war, whatever we say in the streets of London. I'm terribly depressed about this, because I think what at least our Prime Minister should know better is that if this happens, if this war goes ahead, with all the hypocrisy and the double standards and all the things that we all know lie behind it, then the support for the terrorists of September the 11th is going to increase in ways that we can't even imagine. So that if for no other reason, I think this is a terrible situation we're getting into. There are two or three other points I want to put before the audience. I'm very alarmed, and I think this is something we should really watch out for, that the only people opposing the war against Iraq or the people who are disturbing this convergence are these damn Muslims. I think this is a very dishonest view of what is happening. The march on Saturday was fantastic, not only because I'm also a child of the 60s and like the good old days, but because it brought together the most extraordinary range of people, you know. I mean, unimaginable. I went to Richard and Ruthie Rogers' house for supper the other night. They were on the march, and they were marching, you know, side by side with probably some other unspeakable anti-Semites, not necessarily agreeing with them. These are the dangers of marches, always happens. But what was very clear is that there was this coming together because all sorts of people from Hampstead to Brixton to Bolton just see through the unconvincing rhetoric of our Prime Minister and George Bush, but also see the dangers that lie ahead if we go ahead with it. So I think we need to get... Now, of course, some Muslims themselves have promoted this idea that everything that happens is somehow a war against Islam. I think it's deeply unhelpful because it actually isolates all the other people who feel equally strongly that we need a better world and a world which is fairer, more equal, and based on framework. And one last point I wanted to put to you, that Europe has, in my view, an extraordinarily important role to play, because the trust amongst Middle Eastern countries, among Muslims in Europe, around the world, Africans, a lot of Africans, the trust for Europe has shot up this year. And they crave a kind of presence which is going to be the answer to the vacuum that was left after the end of the Cold War. Europe, this could be its moment of destiny. Unfortunately, it's too weak and woolly to understand that at the moment. But I do think that Europe could just provide some way out of this extraordinarily difficult period and fragmentation that we seem to be in the middle of. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Chris Bryan.
Thanks. When Mary asked me to do this, she said she wanted me to give a sceptical perspective. She didn't tell me what she wanted me to be sceptical about, I suppose. She was like, what have you got, I should have asked. I want to start by saying I'm not at all sceptical about the excellent volume at 1599. The study of the kind of institutions, non-state institutions, not-for-profit NGOs, areas of international political public space that this book covers seems to be absolutely essential. It's a major part of any kind of notion of what international relations is about nowadays. An excellent production, I agree with Anna, even better than last year's. A little bit of scepticism about civil society. The IR department at LSE is always accused of obscurantism, with good reason, I might add. And I like the term civil society. I go back to the Scottish Enlightenment on this. I think the people who invented the notion of civil society had it right. What they said was that civil society was the basis for the freedom of the moderns as opposed to the ancient world, but it presumed the existence of an effective state power. Civil society without the state presents real kinds of problems. We've talked, both the previous speakers have talked about the march last week. Somebody commented, this was the biggest march in London for 6 days. I think one of the problems is, you know, £400,000 of people out 1 week, 300,000 people out the next week. If we are to endorse last week, does that mean we endorse fox hunting? Does it mean we are in favour of throwing money at agriculture? And I think the no, it doesn't. Good. We can agree on that. We need state authority. And I think the problem is simply getting the numbers is a very valuable expression of the views of civil society, but it doesn't solve the problems. It doesn't solve the problems in London or Genoa or Seattle. The problem of the world at the moment, if you like, is the absence of effective global government. And I think we're going to have to live with that for the foreseeable future. The power holders are not going to allow effective global government. In any event, I don't think there's a sufficient basis for global consensus at the moment on the terms in which such a government could possibly be anything remotely democratic. So that's first a point. 9/11. No fundamental change, in my view, took place last year. I share Jasmine's view on this in some respect. My reference point wouldn't actually be Srebrenica, it would be Rwanda. The world allowed a genocide. 3,000 people is a lot in the world trade. Let's not minimise this. It's more deaths than there have been in the entire North campaign for the last 30 years. But on a world historical scale, what's significant about 9/11 isn't 9/11, it's the reaction to it and what's happened since. So I go on. No fundamental change. What it provided was a reality check. And at this point, people are going to disagree with me, so those people have been nodding so far. One of the things that this has done, it's increased fragmentation, the first two speakers have suggested. I think in some respects that's not a bad thing. I think we were developing a kind of totalizing view of the world over the last 10 years, bundling all problems into one, the environment, northern unemployment, southern poverty, human rights, justice in the Middle East, justice in Kashmir. And this is all sort of scrunched together, and this becomes kind of the global capitalism, globalization. And in the crude version of this, it becomes, of course, America. The problem becomes America. We get a sense in which everything we don't like in the world is bundled into this bundle. And it becomes a kind of, I think of this as a kind of reverse American exceptionalism. The American exceptionalists were people who thought that America was uniquely virtuous in the world. It was a city on the hill. It could give a model and a lead to the rest of the world. This was the one last hope of mankind. Noam Chomsky believes exactly the same thing, but with a minus sign in front of every statement. And to my mind, both negative and are oversimplifications, and they're dangerous oversimplifications. They push us in looking the wrong direction. So the sense that there are enemies out there who are not simply Americans and global capitalism, it was quite a good wake-up call, quite a good reminder. 9/11 is a reminder that things don't always add up. Not everybody who is anti-American is progressive. Not everybody who is anti-capitalist is a progressive. Karl Marx knew that perfectly well. I mean, Marx's critique of capitalism rejected very strongly the kind of romantic vision of capitalism, romantic critique of capitalism that was being offered by so many people at the time. I think over the last few years, we've kind of pushed that aside. Some of the people who are anti-capitalism and anti-American are fascists. Some of them are Islamo-fascists, some of them are Judeo-fascists, some of them are Christo-fascists, Hindu-fascists. There may be Buddha-fascists out there, I'm not quite sure. Sri Lanka, very good. I'm prepared to leave that. But the central point is that we shouldn't assume that there is kind of, as I think some people have over the last few years, that there is one enemy in the world. There are lots of enemies. There are lots of people. There are people out there who are worse than the bureaucrats who work for the WTO. A degree of acknowledgement of that doesn't do any harm. Now, of course, to some extent, that acknowledgement has been, some members of the anti-global capitalism movement have attempted to kind of see 9/11 as ultimately the US's fault, and of course you can point to stupid things in the past and bad things, which is a kind of superficial credence to that. Some people see Islamo-fascism as a response to injustice, and I suspect that's not taking the theocracy seriously enough, not taking the theology seriously enough. Worst of all, and I think this is absolutely right, there's been a kind of excessively arrogant victim culture, I think that's a phrase Philip Roth used recently, in the United States, sustained the sense that, you know, how could something like this happen to us, which hasn't been very helpful. And of course, George W.'s foreign policy initiatives over the last year or so haven't always been. I don't think the record of the American administration is quite as bad as Jasmine and Mary implied, but it certainly doesn't win a very high score in terms of making friends and influencing people. So I think there has been a sense in which the kind of message of 9/11, that message of the complexity of world problems, has been slightly dissipated. I'd still hang on to the main point, that we've been reminded it's a hard world out there. Not all the bad guys are on the side. There's lots of different bad guys. We have to make choices in politics, and that's what politics is about. The second point would be even less palatable to a lot of people, I think, and that's about the role of force in international relations, generally speaking. I think in the last 10 years, the European powers in particular have turned their back on military force. They've developed a civilian power. They've emphasized soft power, the power of the attractions of EU membership, for example, to the East European. And in many ways, this has been a very valuable initiative, and there's quite a lot of things you can do as a civilian power. But I think we've had a bit of a reminder in the last year that there are some things you can't do as a civilian power. And that the violence that is characteristic of the world, and from lots of different causes, isn't something that can necessarily I think the current Israeli-Palestinian situation is a very good illustration of that. Once, as I profoundly hope they do, those people in Israel who want to secure Israel and people in Palestine who want to secure a second Palestinian state alongside Israel, once those two groups get together and manage to marginalize the people who want to destroy Israel on one side and the people who want a greater Israel on the other, once those two groups get together and start working the peace process, European Union money is going to be incredibly important, as it has been in the past. But I'm afraid, like it or not, that money isn't actually going to produce the Arabs and the Israelis and the Palestinians getting together. If they do get together, it will be because of pressure from the United States, which unfortunately doesn't seem particularly inclined to exert. Now, I'm not trying to suggest a kind of apocalyptic clash of civilizations here. That's not, I think, going to happen. Civilizations are divided internally in all sorts of ways. It's just not a very helpful category. But I think we can assume that there are irreconcilable positions in the world. Force isn't going to be an eliminable part of world politics. I think over the last 10 years, a lot of people, especially in Europe, have kind of convinced themselves. We're going to carry on living, I think, in a fairly tense, conflictual world. And we're going to have to accept that absolute security simply isn't possible. And I think that's a message for two groups of people. It's a message for Mary's utopians, but it's also a message, of course, for those people who believe in preemptive war. The idea of a continual process of preemptive war to bring total security is nonsense. There is no total security in the world as it is. We have to live with risk. We need a cool head. We need intelligent diplomacy, which I fully agree there's not enough of around at the moment. But I think it's better that in some ways we know this. I don't think this was created by 9/11. I think what 9/11 did was remind us of this fact. It's better that we know this, that we live in a kind of false paradise. 9/11 didn't create this situation. It reminded us that it already political system. That's the kind of world which, perhaps unfortunately, you live in. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And last but not least, Naomi Klein.
Mary, that I thought if I went last, I would figure out something to say. And sure enough, that has happened. I'm also very pleased to be here. I wasn't involved in producing the book, but I definitely support the project. And I do believe that for better or for worse, something very significant changed on September 11th, even if we question the assumptions of why it changed. And I agree with the assessment in the book that there was a new openness towards dialogue that was going on inside and outside the barricades. And I was experiencing some of this firsthand, but one thing I would want to add to that is that it was an uncomfortable and problematic dialogue that was going on between so-called civil society and government representatives and corporate representatives. This is the idea of that we could solve the world's problems through sort of civil partnerships between governments, socially responsible businesses, and civil society represented by NGOs. I find this idea problematic on many levels. I tend to be more in favor of civil disobedience than civil society at this point, especially because I think the idea of corporate social responsibility post-Enron, post-WorldCom has been sufficiently undermined that it is worth asking whether sometimes we aren't just a little bit too civil in the face of this. And that the role of ethical leadership is, in fact, I think, should be to help us get really angry sometimes. I started getting these invitations from the Belgian Prime Minister to dialogue, and I actually participated in that because my rule about these things is that I'll debate anyone in public but nobody in private. And what was interesting about what Guy Verhofstadt, who was then head of the EU, what was interesting about his invitation was that it was an invitation to a public debate, not a sort of closed-door consultation partnership meeting. You know, the media was there. It was open. But being there, it was extraordinarily stage-managed, and we all felt very manipulated, and we were all very consciously hand-selected, and we were pretty much as safe as you could get in terms of representatives of so-called civil society. And I saw a more problematic version of that use of civil society as a kind of a fig leaf for the status quo in Quebec City when we hosted the Summit of the Americas last April. Because my government did something very uncivil, which is they built a fence around the whole downtown in order to have a meeting about how free trade was going to bring greater democracy. And this fence, which forced residents of Quebec City to carry identification to get to home and work, was challenged under the Canadian Constitution by a group of lawyers and civil liberties advocates, as saying that it obviously violated our constitutional right to freedom of assembly in our public streets. And I stress this was not a fence around a conference center. This was a fence around a downtown core. And the Canadian government won that lawsuit. And it was very interesting, I mean, it was very not very reported at all, that their defense in court, and a defense that held, was that they weren't, in fact, shutting out citizens from participating in decision-making, in governance, in this extraordinarily ambitious idea of creating a free trade area for all of the Americas and the Caribbean, for 34 countries. You'd think it'd be something that we might have something to say about. They said that they weren't violating those rights because they had issued 12 invitations to NGOs. And they refused to even say who they had issued the invitations to or if they had accepted. But the very fact that they had had a meeting, made a list of NGOs, issued the invitations, was used successfully in court as a justification for this fence. And that's when I think we start to realize something kind of fishy was going on with this whole idea of civil society, or that we had lost the plot. And I was invited to a meeting that's also mentioned in the book. It was in Paris of before September 11th. It was organized by a group called Project Z. This is a group that has organized dialogues between Davos and Porto Alegre. They've organized televised debates. And they decided to have a meeting with representatives of the World Trade Organization and the World Bank and the movement, okay, to talk about how they were going to have future debates. So it was a discussion about debating. And it was, a bunch of us got an email inviting us to this, and it wasn't clear to me how I got on this list. I mean, I'm an author. I don't even have an NGO. I represent absolutely no one, but yeah, I was being invited to meet with the World Trade Organization on behalf of the movement. And, you know, I said no because I don't do closed-door meetings, but Lori Wallach, who is one of the most prominent critics of the World Trade Organization in the United States, she works with Ralph Nader with the NGO, very strong NGO called Public Citizen, who does do lobbying and closed-door meeting. I mean, she wrote back a wonderful response on the email list where she said, you're just trying to make us as unrepresentative as you are. and that won't be a victory because, of course, the critique of these organizations is that it is a hand-selected group of people who meet behind closed doors and decide how the world should be run. So it is by no means a victory if we somehow get invited to these closed-door meetings and become as unrepresentative and undemocratic as they do. So that idea, that rapprochement, if you will, I think that was happening before September 11th and was largely shut down after September 11th with some exceptions. You know, I'm not so sure we should be sad to see it go, to be honest. The other thing that's happened post September 11th in our kind of American-centric view of the world is the idea that the movement against, or the movements against neoliberalism, or global capitalism, or whatever you want to call it, is dead. I hear this all the time. Every time I do an interview, I'm told, well, isn't the movement dead after September 11th? And this in and of itself is absurd, because, I mean, look at what just happened in Brazil yesterday. Lula almost won the elections. He probably will in the runoff. These neoliberal policies, which mostly manifest themselves in Latin America through privatizations of basic services, of water, of electricity, have been ground to an absolute halt, not by civil society, but by social movements. And I think at this point we need to start making a clear distinction between civil society, which I think originally the idea was that civil society was part of social movements, between civil society and social movements. I would say that social movements are accountable and grounded in their communities. They're rooted. They reject the idea of people being a special interest group that gets invited to roundtable discussions, you know, in Johannesburg or Durban or Geneva. I think attempts to demote every other sector to the status of a special interest group. People are not a special interest group; they are society, And we saw this in a really interesting way just now during the Earth Summit, or Rio Plus 10 in Johannesburg. Because in this idea of the three-way partnership, it wasn't born in Rio, but it took a significant leap forward in Rio at the first Earth Summit. And this was Maurice Strong's vision of a new kind of summit. He didn't want a summit that would just bring governments together. He wanted to bring together all the stakeholders. And the way Maurice Strong defined the stakeholders was government, states, businesses that were polluting, as well as representatives of environmental organizations, indigenous groups, civil society, and these three major parties would come together, and they would all, in a very civil manner figure out how to save the planet. Now, 10 years on from Rio, the track record of that particular model is abysmal on many levels. And the whole landscape has changed in 10 years, because in Rio, there weren't huge protests on the streets. There weren't social movements saying not only to their governments, not only to their business leaders, but to their NGO leaders, you don't represent us. But that's what was going on in Johannesburg. to the extent that it forced many NGO representatives to walk out at the end of the summit and no longer be complicit in the ultimate fig leaf, which was the idea that that we could move forward without any kind of regulation, but it would be all this best practices partnerships between Ericsson and the Red Cross. And outside on the streets of Johannesburg were tens of thousands of people from the townships of Soweto and Alexandra saying, my water was just cut off, my electricity was just cut off. And we think that the deals that you're making inside have something to do with it. So I think that we need to talk a little bit less about civil society, a little bit more about social movements. Thank you.
Right, there you have it, on the one hand, and on the other hand, lots and lots of different threads, and very important ones too. Who wants to speak first or ask a question of any of our speakers? Yes.
Yeah, I think like a demonstration.
Could you give us your name? I shouldn't say this, but I presume you were one of the 37% who voted in the last election then. Good luck. Yes.
September 11th as something different. Now, without, of course, Srebrenica and Rwanda were horrible, but I would have thought the precedents were much more Jonestown and what happened on the Japanese subway. In other words, Al-Qaeda isn't new. Since the beginning of recorded history, there have been millenarian sects who believe that you had to destroy in order to create. And they did so, but on a very tiny scale. And what happened on September 11th was we all had to be aware that we were in a new ball game where these sects who don't have, there isn't a goal. It's not like the IRA setting off a bomb and they would leave and stop doing that if they got what they wanted. There was no question of destroying America with those airplanes, but we suddenly realized that very small groups of people using modern technology can do enormous destruction. This is real. We're all slightly afraid, but the powers that be, because there is this malevolent thing out there that's new and they don't know how to cope, this also poses an enormous threat to civil liberties and civil society. I'll stop there, but I just feel that we are in a new ball game, and that shouldn't be minimized.
Chris, do you want to say something about that? Well, just very briefly, I don't think, describing the people who did this as part of a millennial sect, I mean, a sect is one of those terms, you know, we never admit we're in a sect, it's all somebody else. It seems to me these guys were just as goal-directed as the IRA. They were more ruthless than the IRA, but just as goal-directed. Well, the goal, basically, was to get America to do some of the things it actually has done over the course of the last year. That is to say, to heighten the tensions in relations between the West and the Arab world. The goal was to try and marginalize the position of Muslims in Western society, to create a much higher level of tension. And to some extent, they've succeeded, although to give George W. some credit, he's made quite a considerable attempt to not make this an anti-Muslim campaign, at least in the United States. I mean, people sometimes talk about anti-Muslim activity in the US. I don't think any mosques have been destroyed in the States. One or two synagogues have been in Europe. So I don't think we're minimizing it, but I also don't think that we should kind of assume that this is a deeply irrational act. Dostoevsky in Manhattan is what Glucksmann wrote a book called about this. I think that's basically wrong, although it's a good book.
Thank you. Can I just add a word?
Yes.
I think it's also a mistake to see this without any reference to the perceived limitless power of the United States. The feelings young people, and remember these men were part of their lives in the United States, that the sense that with the Cold War, which had its huge problems, something was more balanced in the world than it felt, than has felt in the last decade. Now for some young men, maybe this was a response to that awful feeling that too much power is lies with one country. Now, it's not an excuse, but I think it would be a terrible mistake to misunderstand this and to dismiss these people as somehow members of a sect. There is a terrible political sense of humiliation and inferiority around the world today, and some people are reacting to it in ways which we don't understand.
Isn't that sense of inferiority and lack of control also very implicit in Muslim states who don't recognize democracy?
Yes.
And what's
to
be done about them?
Completely.
Isn't that part
yes.
of the problem?
It's part of the problem, but again, around Africa, Africans are completely kind of lost on this one. They don't feel able to deliver the sympathy that they're expected to, because they feel really let down by the politics in the last 10 years, you know. So it's bigger than that. Of course, the abysmal Muslim states around the world doesn't help Muslims feel any better about who they are, but again, I think it's wider than that.
Yes, somebody in the front row and then behind.
First of all, I just want to...
Can you tell us who you are?
My name is Elan Barron. I'm a MSc student here. Oh, great. Okay. I have a... First of all, I just really enjoyed what everyone had to say, and thank you all for taking your time out to come here and speak to us. And I have three very short sort of question comments. The first one is, I don't really feel that I wasn't in... Well, I'm from North America. When I came back, because I was in the Middle East on September 11th, it seemed to me that everyone had gone insane because I didn't really sense that anything had changed. But I sort of observed and I put this out, that if anything, what happened was sort of the people kind of became hyper... There was a sense of hyper-realism. And I use realism not in the IR term, but more in a kind of general... just a general term. Second one is more specifically to what you're saying, Ms. Klein, about, I guess, civil society being co-opted. And it seems to me that if the problem is being co-opted into a liberal world, I'm not so sure that the examples that you gave were any different. If anything, the emphasis might be different, but underneath the language might stay the same, that the demands essentially are the same, although the language and, or the demands might be the same, but the emphasis, the root might be slightly different. But we're still asking for either essentially some sort of liberal, like Ignatieff type of demand, right? I mean, I hear even the conservatives saying the same sort of thing, right? Compassion conservatism, but you know, it different priorities. So I'm skeptical that there's really in the long run much difference there. And my third question, it seems to me there's something disturbing about the view of progress being presented so far, and one would be a peaceful version, right, the utopian example given, and the other as a violent version, which is inherently bad. But then, if we're talking about transformation, right, who's to say which one is necessarily better? I mean, even Marx was very aware. I mean, he said that you needed violence, right, that it was going to have violence, and then it would get better, right? So I'm sort of uneasy about exactly where the different views go.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that this is a direct answer to what you've asked, but I certainly, it's more an answer to the discussion that we've been having so far. One is on the point about, was September the 11th significant, and was it any more significant than Rwanda and Srebrenica? And was, Yasmin was talking about how people feel about America. But I think there is a problem if we don't equally take seriously the problems of fundamentalism and extremism. I do think that, and here I actually agree with Chris on this point, I do think that what... I don't think people can hear you.
Can the microphone be switched on?
Can you hear me? Yeah. I do think that, you know, people were shaken by September the 11th. Maybe not people in the West, people in America, people in Europe, that we live in a sophisticated society that's very vulnerable, where you don't actually need nuclear or chemical or biological weapons to cause mass destructions, and where there are people with very fundamentalist, extremist, exclusivist, nasty ideas. And when you were saying to me, we can't be marginalized on the streets, I would love it. I mean, I'm with you all the way. But my fear is that if we can't give an answer to fundamentalism and extremism, and what, for example, and I'm not just talking about Al-Qaeda, I'm talking about Hindu fundamentalists, I'm talking about what Israel is doing in Palestine. If we can't give an answer to fundamentalism, then we will be marginalized, because people are genuinely worried about that. So that's one point. Second point is on, and again it relates to your point, is on civil society. Chris said, well, you can't really have, and this is a debate we've had for a long time, you can't have civil society without a state. Civil society was predicated on rules. What I think is it was predicated on rules which were based on consent rather than on coercion. And rules and civil society made each other. And what global civil society is about is making rules at a global level. It's about constituting rules. And so it's an emergent global civil society. And to the extent there are rules, there is more space for global civil society. And I think that civil society has to include not just social movements, but also the NGOs who get co-opted. It has to include people who cooperate as well as people who are confrontational. And the reason for using the term civil society rather than social movements is it's the term that everyone agrees about. It's the term that the right agree as well as the left, at least in the West. And so it gives an opportunity for a platform, for a debate, for a discussion. There was something else I wanted to say, but never mind. It was force. This was the point, force. You know, when Chris says we have to come to terms with force in the world, I actually think the world has changed, and that if America can pressure Israel, it's not actually because of military power, it's because of all kinds of other things, the legacy of the past, its economic power. I think military power can be very destructive nowadays, but that's all it can be. And we no longer, the key point was that Al-Qaeda was not Japan. It was not a foreign enemy state. It was a group. And the way you deal with those groups is not through war, but through rules, through establishing legitimacy. You might need, Javier Solana is fond of saying we're a civilian power with military means. You might need military means to uphold law. You might need policing. You might need enforcement to uphold law. But that's very, very different from going to war. And I think, again, that's what global civil society is about. It's about constituting rules which can be enforced globally, and that is the only way you can deal with the al-Qaedas of this world, not through global military power.
Can I just, I mean, I agree with you about the fanatics, and there are fanatics who are backing the war against Israel in the United States. I don't think one should ever forget that. My point is that if progressive and you know, people who want the world to be a much more, much less divided place, watch the so-called morality of the West, you know, where we no longer know what's happening to those men in Cuba. Okay, we just don't know. What are they being tried of? What are they being accused of? What has happened to them? The way this war is being sold is so immoral, really, that for those progressive forces, be it in Iran or be it in Afghanistan, to begin to talk about these global values becomes more difficult, and the fanatics win because they can say quite rightly, look at the West. It doesn't even live by its own rules. That's the problem.
I think the problem is that they'd say that even if the West did live under its own rules.
Oh, no, but it rebalances it.
And fundamentalism is obviously a major problem, and there are kind of symmetries here. You've got loonies in the US who believe that Armageddon is going to take place in the rapture and the second coming, but on the other hand, if you go to the Hamas website and read the Hamas covenant, you find that Zionists were responsible for the French Revolution along with Rotarians and Lions for some reason. I never quite understood that one. Mary's point, I mean, states, no state has ever survived for any serious period of time without degree of consent, but no state has ever survived for any serious amount of time without a capacity for coercion as well. And it seems to me that's something that it's very, very difficult to get around. Mary said that the way to handle this is by legitimacy globally, and I'm sure that's right, and rules globally, and I'm sure that's right. But enforcing global rules without military power is a hard trick to do. It's like enforcing law without the police force. So I don't think we can get around the fact that the world at the moment does not appear to be ready to move to a step of a higher level of global governance. And this isn't simply, I would stress this, it's not simply about the people who hold power not wanting to leave it, although that's also true. There's also a fundamental lack of consensus. Let me give you just one illustration, because I know we want to move on. The International Criminal Court, it's an obvious fact that one of the big issues about the ICC has been the fact the United States has refused to join it and is trying to subvert it. Another big issue about the ICC is not one major Asian country has actually signed or ratified it. The Asian countries are nodding. If we have a global democratic system, we're not going to have an international criminal court because China, India, and the other major Asian countries are not up for it. The global consensus ain't there yet. In the long run, it may come, and we all hope it does, but I suspect, well, I don't think it'll be in my lifetime. It might be in some of yours. It's a longer run, a long run.
There seems to be, I mean, this terrific build-up of pressure between the Muslim world and the rest of the world has blowholes, doesn't it? It has possible points of relief, and one of them is Palestine.
Yep.
I remember after September the 11th, both Jack Straw and Tony Blair talking about the need for a Palestinian state.
Absolutely.
And then it all went away.
Yeah.
Where did it go?
I think both sides have screwed up in Palestine. You've got four parties to this. You've got a group of Palestinians who want to destroy Israel and another group of Palestinians who want a Palestinian state. You've got a group of Israelis who want greater Israel, and you've got another group of Israelis who want to secure Israel within the existing boundaries. What we've got to try and do is to get the two groups of sane people in the Middle East together and marginalise the other two groups. This is not proving easy, to put it mildly. And I think that this is where I'm not as critical of the US as the other members of the panel. I do criticise the US on this one, that they haven't used the weight they've got to put the pressure on the Israelis and on Arafat to marginalise their extremes.
Yes.
Thank you. My name's Brian Gill. I am an MSc student in finance and accounting and an American, so not surprisingly, I am pro-capitalist, but and pro-globalist. But one of the reasons I'm here, not just at this lecture, but also at LSE, is because I'm intensely interested not in how we can evolve as a global society in such a way that we sort of protect ourselves from this type of global unrest that we've been seeing in the future. And I agree with one of the panelists that made the point that the EU and the U.S. have both squandered an enormous opportunity in the light of September 11th to enact real change, but I disagree with why I think that they've done that. And I think that both sides of the European and U.S. debate are both focusing on the symptoms, but not on the cure and the underlying things that are fueling the disease, which I think is radicalism within certain societies in the world. And the things that are propping up the oppressive regimes in the Middle East are oil and drug trafficking. And the U.S. has sure as hell not done anything whatsoever to move in the direction of less dependence on global oil, even though the EU and other countries in the world have been very supportive of Kyoto. I think that the most courageous step in leadership that's happened over the past couple of years in moving us towards that goal of undercutting these regimes and the money that's going towards supporting these radical causes came out of California when they said by 2010 we are going to cut we want all vehicles sold into the state to be zero emissions. And because of that, now the big three and global automakers are scrambling. The oil energy companies are scrambling to prepare for that. So my question is, why? You know, I'd love to see, as the panel has pointed out, the EU come out and take a leadership position to address some sort of a major problem like that. But I'm curious as to why, you know, even though there's this prevalent attitude amongst the world about things like Kyoto, why haven't there been courageous moves like that in this movement? And second, shorter question to Naomi Klein. I found it interesting that you said that you refuse invitations to attend private debates behind closed doors, but yet you're a journalist. And having spent the last 3 years in the public relations industry, I find it curious that you don't view your position as one that encourages debate that goes on behind closed doors to come on the other side of those doors. So I'm curious on your perspective on that.
Fine. Do you want to say anything? All right, let's take a few more questions. And then, but Naomi, maybe perhaps you very briefly while we're doing that, like to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda Sixpence.
I'm not sure I really understand the question, because I do see my role as being a public role, and I think the idea of going behind closed doors makes it not a debate, but it's some kind of a negotiation. I do try to encourage as many of those internal debates to become external debates, and I have very little luck with it. I mean, I also get a lot of invitations to have closed door meetings with corporations. After No Logo was published, there was a lot of interest in, you know, from branding companies and advertising companies, and as you can imagine. And I would, you know, always say, well, like, let's do it at the library, you know, or let's do it where it can be a debate and not a consultation. And I just wouldn't get my phone calls or emails returned after that. So I think that there have been some exceptions in terms of a willingness to take those private debates to the outside, but I lose control once it goes inside. It can be used in ways that I can't control because there's no record of it.
Thanks very much. Yes, at the back, and then somebody in the front row.
Zuka Lechner, PhD Government, and I would like to ask the panel to comment a bit about your conceptualization, your definition of the term global civil society. Because it seems to me that this is more a utopian term rather than an analytic one. And I would like to ask the following two questions. How global is this civil society that you're talking about really? And secondly, society is usually something very heterogeneous, but you seem to equal the society that you're talking about seems to be anti-capitalist, but I don't really see a consensus on that. So my question is, how do you conceptualize this term, global civil society?
Thank you. I'll take another question here, and then we'll put them all together.
My name is John Keane. I could comment to Naomi Klein, that I think if you're going to think politically about social movements, you require strategically, ethically, analytically, the term civil society, and that their contraposition, I think, is pretty much, it leads into a cul-de-sac. Or I could say to Chris Brown that to say that civil society presupposes a state is very short on history. Many civil society institutions grew up in empires. And in any case today, the relationship between the two is utterly contingent. But I really want to make some a comment really to all of you, because I think you're all amnesiacs, and I think that it would have been very useful to have an historian here. As much as one sees that September 11th was a rupture, as much as one sees that it also is a deep insult to many millions of people because of the fetish of that day, I think there is a serious point in the social sciences about continuities amidst discontinuities. It's Tocqueville and others' point. I mean, look for the continuities ought to be a rule as much as looking for discontinuities. And what does September the 11th teach us? Well, polemically, it's become much clearer that there is a dominant power, only the fourth since Habsburg, that there are endemic problems, the irrational exuberances of the global economy, that there are new forms of violence that predated September the 11th, that the whole thing was a big, grand media event, and that the globalization process, as last time round, is very much wrapped in communications systems that are space and time busting. But the biggest point, I think, it's the comment, and you may not want to comment on it, is that I think that it's forcing us, intellectually speaking, to compare the last round, the great growth spurt of globalization between roughly 1875 and 1930, and this one dating roughly from, well, whenever, the end of the 60s or 70s until now. And one thing, I think, amidst all the similarities but the differences, one thing that's very striking, to me at least, is that last time round, it all came crashing down in a global economic crisis, in fascism, the rise of xenophobia and so on, because no proper, effective and legitimate structures of government were put in place to, as it were, steer and guide that process of globalization. Chris Brown has commented on this, but I wondered whether the others of you could talk about whether you think we're still living in a world of states or something different, and whether there are any prospects for global governance from here on.
Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry, paper,
I think you should be sitting down here.
I think you should. Both comments, I've given my point on global civil society earlier, that I'm very sceptical about it, and I'm not totally convinced that global civil societies are something that can be divorced from the state. I mean, effective political power is what I said, rather than the state, and within empires you have that. But this is getting, I think that's less interesting than the other issue you raised. And what strikes me about that second issue is that the two points you made in some respects go in different directions. I think your first point is absolutely right, except you underestimate it. We have a dominant power here which of a level that hasn't been seen since the Roman Empire. Forget the Habsburgs. I mean, the entire modern state system, there hasn't been the kind of dominance that there is. The interesting question about that is whether you can still play that dominance in a world which has moved somewhat beyond the old world of states, and this is where the new technologies, the new networks come in. America is the most powerful military power, 40% of global military spending, 80% of global R&D, and yet still dealing with relatively small terrorist groups is proving enormously problematic. So what the meaning of this dominance is a key question. The second point, though, is I think you quite rightly make the point, and Meghnad Dan has made it many times as well, that the first globalization collapsed in war. What is going to happen this time? One of the reasons might not happen this time is precisely because the first globalization took place in a world of states where there were still four or five major powers that could have a war. That kind of war simply is not going to happen in the foreseeable future because we do have a hegemonic world power. American power is going to be challenged. It already has been, and that's what 9/11 was about. But it won't be challenged in the way that British power was challenged in 1914, because there's no power in the world that is in the position to be able to deliver that challenge. So I think the two halves of what you're saying are both right, but I think that in some respects they play against each other.
Do you want to answer the other question that was asked as well about this whole concept of global civil society, very briefly?
I think I would claim I already had, that I'm very sceptical of the notion of global civil society. It's not a phrase I would use myself. I'm perfectly happy other people can use it, but to my mind, that we do not have a global civil society. What we have is a kind of international public space where a lot of non-state actors interact with each other and with states. To call that a civil society, let alone a global civil society, seems to me to add on a layer of description which really can't be justified in the current circumstances. Over to Mary.
Let me first start with John.
I think you need to speak into a microphone because people are really finding it difficult to hear.
Okay, let me...
like a pop star.
Let me first start with John's question. I have the view that America's dominance really is a matter of our own perceptions. I think that, I mean, what Chris said, that of course in monetary terms, America spends an enormous amount on the military. But in fact, in practice, what it can do with that, what it can do with anti-ballistic missiles, son of Star Wars, what it can do with its military power, especially as it's not prepared to risk casualties, is quite limited. It can be very destructive. And if it had allies, like the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, it can achieve something. But it actually is quite limited. And if you think about the fact that Afghanistan was the poorest country in the world and how much effort the United States had to put into toppling the Taliban, it gives you some idea that American military power is not actually as great as we tend to think about it. And I think our belief in American dominance is really based on a belief. Because we think America is dominant, America is dominant, and I think it could easily change. So I'm much less convinced of the dominance of American power in the long term. Second question is, where are we going? Are we going back to a world of states? And I think this also relates to the military power question. I think precisely because all kinds of weapons have become increasingly destructive, precisely because in modern society you can inflict mass destruction without having very sophisticated weaponry, precisely for those reasons, it's very difficult to envisage military power as the basis for effective power and political power in the future. What I think can happen, if we can't get it together and make rules, is that we'll live in a very nasty, violent, anarchic world. I don't think we'll go back to a world of states like we did in 1914. I think we can either go in the direction of greater global governance, greater global rules, or we'll go in the direction of American destructiveness, to be sure, but also greater terror, greater violence, greater risk, greater insecurity, and that's probably the most likely direction that we face. On the definition of global civil society, I do invite you to come and join our global civil society discussion group, which meets on Wednesdays at lunchtime, because we endlessly discuss the definition of global civil society. We have a formal definition which refers to individuals, I've forgotten it, Marlies gave it earlier today, individuals, ideas, values between the family, the market, and the state that cross borders, something like that. But we all of us have very different ideas. And for me, what civil society is about the medium through which the individual negotiates with the centers of political and economic power. And the reason that I think global civil society is a relevant and important term today is precisely because we live in a world of important global political and economic institutions. And there are mechanisms, however undeveloped, through which individuals can negotiate with those institutions, can confront those institutions, can cooperate with those institutions. They're very underdeveloped, but they exist, and the only hope for establishing a global system of rules is to develop those further. So it's both a term which describes what's happening in the sense of movements, NGOs, networks, but it's also a term which has a normative premise. Thank you.
I just wanted to, that wonderful questions you asked, John, I'm going to think about them, but I do think that the perceptions at the moment about the new virtual empire facing a new virtual enemy is that it is without responsibility. Now, I'm just telling you what the perception, that at least with the old empires, they did build the lavatories and the railways and the schools, and there was some sense of obligation to the lands that were being dominated, although morally it was questionable what they were doing. At the moment, it feels as if that is completely gone, that the only deal is there is this thing called globalization, which is the right of capital to move around. There is no such thing as those same people being globally civilized or globally responsible. And therefore, it feels like a very difficult game. But you see, I think we will get there, and it won't be in my lifetime. These normative values are important wherever you look. We won't get there if the movement for the global civil society ignores some of the vital problems. For example, I'm always amazed that the kind of people involved in these movements never talk about how we treat asylum seekers, for example. It's as if that issue has nothing at all to do with this wonderful thing we're evolving called global civil society, whereas it has everything to do with it. Because if we are going to talk in terms of valuing and looking after each other and developing new relationships, how can this movement so ignore what this catastrophic position of asylum seekers in Europe? So it seems so depoliticized sometimes that it begins to feel meaningless if you want to be part of a much more confrontational political world, which I inhabit, and I agree with Naomi on that, actually.
Naomi, would you like to?
Yeah, I think I should probably just say that I don't feel that we're going to be able to get into any of this in any depth. And I do sort of feel like we've been skimming the surface and speaking in slogans. But I just want to clarify what I was talking about, really, in the distinction between social movements and civil society. My critique of the whole construction of this sphere of civil society, particularly the idea that there is a global sphere of a civil society, is that it seems divorced from any desire to engage with power. And I'm not just talking about a dichotomy between people who protest outside of summits and people who go inside and meet with government. I'm talking about people who understand the way social change happens. I mean, I think that there's a tremendous amnesia that's going on about the fact that change happens by building counterpowers. By engaging with power in that sense, at a deep level, whether it's building trade unions, building consumer groups, building coalitions between consumer groups and labor movements and student movements and farmers, but actual bases of power from which to confront power, whether it's American power or corporate power. And that is what I feel has been missing, and that is what I believe is returning. And if we look at where these globalized economic policies are being successfully challenged, they are not, in my opinion, being successfully challenged by global civil society, although wonderful treaties are being written at that level. They're being challenged at the level of farmers in India organizing successfully against Monsanto, or workers and peasants in Bolivia kicking Bechtel out and saying that water is a human right and they don't want it to be privatized. They are rooted struggles. The same thing is happening in Argentina. And I think that we need to reinsert power into all of these discussions, because I've been part of these roundtables where we all agree. You cannot find anyone, I am convinced, in the world now who will defend Europe's and the U.S.'s agricultural subsidies. Everybody agrees, including the U.S. and Europe, that it is absolutely untenable. But nothing changes. Well, why doesn't it change? It doesn't change because it doesn't have to change. Why doesn't it have to change? Well, it doesn't have to change because nobody is forcing them to change. And I think that what we need to do in response to the, I forget your name, but about you talked about violence. Well, I'm not talking about violence. I think we can talk about power without talking about violence. And that the task for social movements now is to think about new ways of engaging with power and also to challenge the logic of fundamentalism on every level. Because I believe that we are surrounded by fundamentalisms and that there is a lot in common between market fundamentalism, but what we call globalization, and religious fundamentalism, in that what fundamentalists do is they develop a fetish for rules. And these rules are usually articulated in books. Some of them are taught at the London School of Economics. And they love these rules, these elegant systems. They're perfect. They're beautiful. And then they try to force the world to conform to their rules, and they try to export those rules. And when it doesn't work, they get really angry at the people who aren't applying the rules well enough. And if you're a religious fundamentalist, it must be because, you know, women somewhere are showing their ankles. And if you're an economic fundamentalist, it's because Argentina didn't privatize enough. I mean, they sold absolutely everything, including their street signs, to Howard Johnson's, but they somehow didn't do enough of the economic recipe. This is the logic that I think needs to be challenged, but you don't challenge it on the level of of global governments, i.e. coming up with another one-size-fits-all ideology to be imposed. You do it through decentralization and building counterpowers locally that allow for diversity.
Thank you very much. Now, I know there are lots of other people. Lots of other people who want to speak, but it's 7:30 and we have to end the meeting. It's terribly frustrating being in the chair because there are millions of questions I too wanted to ask, and next year if Mary invites me, I want to be down there. I wanted to ask a question about the calibre of political leadership and why we have leaders who are so fundamental and interested in control and not looking for diversity and not inspiring creativity and in confidence and engaging new ways of doing things, but I didn't have time to ask it. So this debate is going to go on and on. I hope you'll read the book. I hope you'll come to the party now on the fourth floor in the Robinson Room where we can continue talking. Thank you very much. Very good
what?
Debate. Third floor.
Top floor.
I'm sorry.
Third floor.
Thank you very much, everyone, and thank you for our panel.
And you can buy books in the Robinson Room at the